Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money from the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Okay, today, jump off topic, maybe only topic for today, house building illiteracy, I think that's the number one cause, matter of fact, I don't think I know, of homelessness or stressed out housing. People might be facing foreclosure or eviction. House building illiteracy. And I'm going to break that down. I have in our program notes here. Let's see. Okay. I have in our program notes here on Blog Talk Radio, if I can wait for my... Well, everything's got to repopulate. Anyway, I would say... 80%, and I have this written down on our thing here, 80% of the severe housing situations out here are people don't know how to build their own house. We're talking about debt-free house. Let me make that clear. Mortgage-free, no government assistance or nothing like that. I would say that's 80% of the problem. 10% of the problem, and we're adding on to this to get to 100, another 10%, what I would say, geography. You have either bought, rented, or even built the house or had somebody else build the house in the wrong geographical location. I would say that's number two. That's the second biggest thing. So that's not 80% of the problem, house building illiteracy. You know, like if you can read a Dick and Jane book, See Spot Run. You know, seriously, if you can, you're literate. All right. Now, and if you can say it, you know, read a Dick and Jane book, See Spot Run, Dick, Sally, Spot, you know, and then if you can write that, Literacy 101. All right. Now, there's house building literacy too. All right. So, like I say, the here's how I have it now. 80% of the people, now, this is homelessness. These are L.A. stats. 80% of the problem is people are house building illiterate. 3% might have a mental health problem. 4% might have a cash flow problem. 10% geography. You're building in the wrong place, geographically speaking. It's probably too high. It could be too much government regulation, not affordable property taxes, or not even buying an affordable structure. If you got to borrow from an institution or get a government loan, that I don't call that affordable housing. And number five, nonprofit miseducation. Now, you know, I'll probably just scale that back to miseducation, but that's 3%. So 90% of the problem is, it's a combination of two things, 80% being that the person is house building illiterate, and then 10% geography. You're in the wrong place. Maybe you shouldn't be in New York City. Maybe you shouldn't be in Brooklyn. Maybe you need to be somewhere in New York State. But my job's in Manhattan, New York City. That's fine. But you make your paycheck in Manhattan or New York City, but then you live maybe an hour away, 2 hours away, in a more sustainable place, dramatically more sustainable. So we're going to cover this. You know, I'm just putting this out there. There's some thoughts I had last night. I said, well, let me put them out there today. Now, let's see. Man, I had two. I feel like boot under the boat eye tree. I had two enlightening conversations. One with a gentleman from Uganda, which I'm not even going to get the content of it, but I got enlightened. And this all has to deal with house building and literacy. And then one of our regular supporters and listeners here over the years, I'm not going to mention his name right now. I don't want to let the cat out the bag, but thank you both. And I'll be back in touch with both of you this afternoon. And I'm trying to find, let's see. But you both got me thinking, and let me, let's see. Oh, I know it. I'm looking for chapter 10. I have an audio of it that I want to play for you guys, okay? Chapter 10 from the book Up from Slavery. Now, let's see if I can. I think I still have it in this audio library I have here. Let's see, wait a minute. Let me see. Oh, man. Okay. I don't. Okay, well, let me find it another way. Let me see if I can find it another way. Okay, I know I got a recording on here, but okay, it won't be. I don't want that. All right, let me. Okay. Man, I must. Well, I need to put it back in here. All right, well. Homework assignment, you can do this on your own. Read chapter 10 of the book, from the book, Up from Slavery. And I'm like, well, phone is getting kind of crazy here. All right. Okay. Okay, well, let me see if, let's see if I have it entered another way. All right, well, all right, Wild and Sue, let me play some more Steve Harvey and I'll try to find this other piece for you.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing. But he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit, so I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and he said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it, I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, I wanted to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday. And I can hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. Says, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This is a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, Man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in the dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this four pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie. Then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass. Then he went back to them jokes. And they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This is Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just say, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I had never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so That was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because the Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at the Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida. I make $300. Then I go to New York. I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
We begin here in the historic Civil Rights District in Birmingham at the entrance of Kelly Ingram Park, where a monument sits to the four girls who were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. That church sits just across the street. It's still an active place of worship today. And if you look to your left, the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, a place where people come from around the world to learn the history and the tolerance it took to change the world. All of this is now part of the National Park Service, but just around the corner from here is the A.G. Gaston Motel, hidden in plain sight. CBS 42's Art Franklin has the story of the place and the man who's a national treasure himself.
I had my high school football banquets in there, and even after I got to be an adult, occasionally came to the lounge.
Birmingham Resource Center Executive Director Bob Dickerson reflecting on days gone by at the A.G. Gaston Motel. Dr. Gaston hired Dickerson to work at his bank, Citizens Federal, in 1984.
I wasn't an important part of his life and his business, but he was such a vital part of man.
It was a time of deep segregation in the South. When Gaston opened the motel in 1954, it was the only place black entertainers and black visitors could stay in Birmingham.
This was the place. I mean, you think about history, world history was made here.
When you look inside of here, you've got to think about the conversations that were held.
Yeah, you got to think about the meetings in there. You got to think about the courage that folks had when they were in these rooms, knowing that that folks, you know, in that day didn't have a problem setting off a few sticks of dynamite.
A pair of bombs exploded here on May 11, 1963, destroying part of the motel. It happened just 2 days after the Big Three, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Fred Shuttlesworth, and Ralph Abernathy, announced a truce with white city leaders and the business community to end a violent showdown between demonstrators and police.
They bombed the motel as they bombed a lot of stuff. But, you know, that didn't stop anything when you really think about it. Now, you know, some people, the four little girls lost their lives and other people lost lives and property, but the movement didn't stop.
The A.J. Gaston Motel was ground zero for civil rights protests and demonstrations. Inside Room 30, that was the war room for the movement. It was also Dr. King's headquarters when he was here in Birmingham.
The courageous acts that took place in that room, you know, strategizing on how to fight Bull Connor and fight white supremacy and bigotry and hatred, you know, that all took place right here.
Gaston's role in the movement can't be minimalized. Blacks enjoyed plush amenities at his motel. He provided jobs and changed lives with the A.G. Gaston Boys and Girls Club. Gaston's fingerprints and footprints are throughout Birmingham, especially the Civil Rights District where his bank stood, the Booker T. Washington Insurance Company, and his business college. The motel is crumbling, shattered, and in disrepair, but finally, it's slated for renovations as part of the Birmingham Civil Rights National Monument.
I'm really encouraged about what's going to happen. It's sad to see it in disrepair, but it's still standing, and I think we have to take some kind of solace and happiness in that.
This is the city, Los Angeles, California, 464.8 square miles of real estate. It takes a lot of departments and agencies to keep it going. Fire, water and power, education, health. There's a department of airports, a harbor department, and libraries. There's also a department for law and order. This is Parker Center. I work here. I carry a badge. It was Monday, June 29th. It was warm in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of homicide. The boss is Captain Brown. My partner's Bill Gannon. My name's Friday. Mrs. Lily Burnham, a real estate broker, had been reported missing. The preliminary investigation indicated a strong possibility of foul play.
The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Bill and I drove over to the offices of the Burnham Realty Company, 9:05 a.m.
Good morning. May I help you?
Police officers, this is Bill Gannon. My name's Friday.
I'll tell Mr. Richmond you're here.
Thank you.
I'll just be a moment.
Oh, take a look at this, Joe. Beautiful home, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can tell quality construction. 3+10, 2 baths, built-ins. What do you figure the asking is?
The what?
The asking price. How much for this one?
Well, I wouldn't have any idea.
Got to be 42.5. Probably take 39.7 today's market.
Is that right?
You bet. I know the market pretty good.
You do, huh?
Every Sunday we go for a drive. Eileen will watch for open houses, you know, furnished models.
Yeah.
We stop and go through them, spend the whole afternoon. We've seen some great buys, Joe.
Well, I didn't know you were interested in the new house.
What makes you say that?
Well, I mean, you're out looking at all those great buys.
Well, you've been out to my place.
That's right.
What's wrong with the house I've got?
Sergeant Friday, this is Mr. Richmond, one of our salesmen.
Sergeant.
My partner, Officer Bill Gannon.
Well, you gentlemen aren't here to buy a house, so I better let you do the talking.
Wonder if we could have your name, miss.
That's right, Miss Walters. Ida Walters.
And you filed a missing report, did you?
Well, yes, sir. I'm Mrs. Burnham's secretary.
Ida phoned them in, Sergeant, on my say-so.
How long has she been missing?
From our happy little circle since Friday afternoon. Went out to show some property about 2 o'clock.
2:15, I saw her drive away.
Did you? Well, then, Ida must have been the last one to see her.
She didn't even phone in again.
Was that unusual?
Yes, sir.
The weekend, gentlemen, that's when we move houses. A man and wife, generally, they can't get out together during the week, so we spend Saturdays and Sundays sitting in a furnished model, wheeling and dealing. You know.
Yes, sir.
Now, you take Miss Lily. She's a businesswoman. Nothing would keep her from a weekend of wheeling and dealing.
Something did.
Yeah, that's why we reported it.
Maybe she's sick.
I called her apartment house. Somebody looked in.
Yes, ma'am.
They don't think she's been there all weekend.
She might have gone out of town. Has that ever happened before?
Not on a weekend.
Does she have relatives?
There's a sister, I think, in Philadelphia. Nobody out here.
Well, there must have been a husband at one time. What about him?
He's never mentioned.
All right. Does she have a boyfriend?
There's Terry Williams, but it looks like he doesn't know anything either.
Mr. Williams has been calling us 2 or 3 times on Friday and again this morning.
I see. Well, maybe there's somebody else.
Wouldn't matter, Sergeant.
Well, how's that?
She had an appointment this morning to close the deal. No man would ever stand between Lily and the commission, or a woman either.
Maybe that's the secret of her success.
You have to understand, gentlemen, I is the president of the Miss Lily Fan Club. I work here just for money. It gives us different perspectives.
Do you need me for anything else?
We'll need a description of Mrs. Burnham.
Well, she's attractive, I guess, if you lack them cold and ruthless. Age, what would you say, Ida?
About 36.
Yeah, 36 going on 42. But she's kept her figure and knows how to dress.
You remember what she was wearing Friday?
Your department, Ida.
It was her paisley linen dress. Over it, she wore a matching linen coat.
What color?
The dress was orange and yellow, and the coat was yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And bone leather shoes with a matching purse. It's very smart.
Yes, ma'am. Anything else?
No, except we're all terribly worried. It's just not like Mrs. Burnham. She must have had an accident or something.
Something has kept her away, but knowing our Lily...
Yeah.
I doubt it was an accident.
Before leaving the Realty office, we learned that Terry Williams, the missing woman's boyfriend, was the day bartender at a bar on West Adams. We also obtained the make, model, and license number of Mrs. Burnham's car. 10:50 a.m., we went back to the office, and after checking R&I, we put out a teletype describing the vehicle with a request that, if observed, to notify Homicide Division. 11:05 a.m., we drove over to West Adams to interview Terry Williams, Mrs. Burnham's boyfriend.
Good morning.
Terry Williams?
That's right.
Police officers.
Mm-hmm. It's about Lily Burnham, isn't it?
That's right.
Only thing it could be. The secretary said they were going to report it if she didn't show up soon. Guess she hasn't, huh?
When did you see her last?
Thursday night. With dinner, a couple of drinks. Broke it up early.
See her over the weekend?
No, sir.
You didn't make a date with her?
Nothing definite. Said I'd call. Maybe we'd get together.
Did you call?
A few times. Got no answer.
How long have you known Mrs. Burnham?
Guess it must be close to a year now.
She got any other boyfriends that you know of?
Don't see how she could. We were together most of the time.
But not over the weekend?
That's right. Because she wasn't in when I called. I explained all that.
Would you happen to have a photograph of her?
No, sir.
Use the phone.
Do you know if Mrs. Burnham carried a lot of cash?
She was never short, but not enough to go very far. If that's what you're thinking.
That's not what I'm thinking.
Robbery? How much do you need to get mugged these days?
Not very much.
Excuse me. Got a customer down here.
Nothing on Williams, local boy, clean all the way through high school.
Yeah.
Mrs. Burnham's car turned up. They want it moved before tonight. They need the space.
Who's that?
Car's in a restaurant parking lot.
A.M. According to the parking lot attendant, the car had been discovered on the lot Saturday morning. It was first assumed the owner, deciding he was incapable of driving, had gone home in a cab and would return for it the next day. When it was still there 48 hours later, it was reported abandoned.
Book of real estate listings.
Keys are in the ignition.
Gas receipt, Mrs. Lily Burnham, 17 gallons.
Tank's almost full. Where'd she buy the gas?
Station out near Hanson Dam.
12 noon. Before leaving the lot, we arranged to have Mrs. Burnham's car gone over by SID. An examination of the loose leaf book revealed 8 listings in the Hanson Dam area. 12:20 p.m., we interviewed the attendant at Jackson and Martin's Super Service. After hearing a description of Mrs. Burnham in her car, he thought he remembered her from last Friday. He was almost certain there had been a man in the car with her, but he was unable to give us any description of him. We got a copy of the recent listings from the Burnham Realty Company. We also picked up a set of keys for the houses. 12:35 p.m., we started checking the various listings. The occupants of the houses told us Mrs. Burnham had not been there at any time in the past month. 12:48 p.m., the third house we checked was vacant and still for sale.
What was it, number 1223?
That's right.
Yeah, here we are. cigarette butts, lipstick on them. Could have been here a long time.
Yeah, I'll check the rest of the place.
Bill. Orange and yellow linen dress, bone shoes, matching handbag.
Yep. Mrs. Lily Burnham.
p.m. In answer to our request, a field supervisor and two radio units arrived at the scene. One unit was stationed at the end of the street to keep out curious onlookers. The other was sent to cruise the area in the hopes of locating witnesses. Men from SID were also dispatched. The room was dusted for fingerprints. Photographs, both in black and white and color, were taken of the victim.
You want to take a look at this now? Outside was wiped clean. $50 in bills.
Inside's pretty neat, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't look like anybody prowled it. Usual stuff in it. Compact lipstick, nail file, comb.
Yeah. Better take these beads along. They're broken.
I was just thinking.
Yeah?
This purse, the stuff in it. Not like my wife's.
What do you mean?
You know what's missing? Credit cards.
Well, we know she had a gas card.
Not anymore, she doesn't.
p.m. The radio unit, which had been cruising the area, had located a possible witness. Frank Stobie, a local handyman, told us that while riding past the house on his bicycle at roughly 2:30 p.m. the previous Friday, he had seen a man and a woman approaching the front entrance. He described the victim's clothing with reasonable accuracy, but he could not recall any details about the man. 5:20 p.m. Bill and I decided to re-interview the victim's boyfriend, Terry Williams. At the Red Quill Bar, we were told that he had already left for the day. We got his home address.
Okay, what is it? What do you want this time?
We want to talk to you again.
Did you find Lily?
We'd like you to come downtown with us, Williams.
So she's dead.
What makes you say that?
It's true, isn't it?
You got a coat?
Are you guys arresting me?
No, we just want to get some more information.
Okay. Let me wash my face.
All right.
Joe? Take a look.
I can just get a clean shirt on.
You look fine.
Then you're not taking me in.
Now listen carefully. You have the right to remain silent. Any statements you make can and will be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand that?
Then you are arresting me.
You have the right to the presence of an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be appointed without charge before any questioning.
Do you understand that?
Yeah, I understand. I just want to know why.
Well, that makes us even.
Hmm?
We just want to know why you've got those four beads.
Oh, I can explain those.
Suppose you do that.
Thursday night. I told you about it. It was my birthday. Lily took me to dinner. Afterwards, we came over here for a little while.
Go on.
She broke her beads. Or maybe I did. One way or the other, the string got busted. I fixed it for her and thought all the beads were on it. But when I sacked out for the night, those four turned up.
Where did they turn up?
On the couch. Except one I found in the cuff of my slacks. Now, that's the truth.
Maybe. But you didn't tell us all that this morning.
I didn't think it was important then.
Why do you think it is now?
p.m. Terry Williams was booked for murder. Under interrogation, he made several conflicting statements. He admitted that last Thursday was not his birthday and that Lily Burnham had been in the habit of picking up all their tabs. He also admitted they had quarreled that night, but he continued to deny having seen her after she left his apartment around midnight. He could not satisfactorily account for his whereabouts at the approximate time of the murder. 8:05 p.m., the suspect agreed to undergo a polygraph examination. It was conducted by Lieutenant W.L. Klingon. 11:30 p.m., we were given the results of the examination.
First, let me say there were strong patterns indicating deception. For instance, a good reading on the money in the victim's billfold.
He knew how much?
On the nose. It's possible she always carried exactly $50. Some people limit themselves to a certain amount.
Yeah.
Also, a good response on the clothes she was wearing, the string of beads getting broken in a quarrel, and the general location of the crime.
What location?
Handsome Dam area. I'll return to that in a minute. I got a positive reading on the victim's death by strangulation. Now, let me ask you a question, Joe, Bill. Where was she killed?
What do you mean, Lieutenant?
Could she have been murdered somewhere else and her body moved into the house?
No, we didn't find any evidence to suggest that. None at all.
Specifically in the victim's car, parked somewhere in an alley.
You got that reaction from Williams?
Very strongly, and it was dark, rather late at night.
We've got a good witness placing the victim at the house about 2:30 Friday afternoon. We think she was strangled shortly after. Coroner might confirm the time, Joe. Yeah, we'll know after the post tomorrow.
All right, let's get back to this reaction on Hanson Dam. Could he have known she was going out there?
Well, the victim might have mentioned it the night before.
Well, I have to tell you, I got no indication at all that he knows the location of the house, or that he took her car, or that he knew where the car was found abandoned.
He just doesn't know the right things, does he? And yet he reacted to her being dead by strangulation.
That's true, but a woman being strangled in a car parked in an alley is a fairly common scene in mystery novels or on TV. Or he could have been reacting to the way he would have done it.
You mean he might have just played back to you something he'd read?
Or saw in the movie, say, in the last 24 hours. And didn't they quarrel Thursday night in his apartment?
Yeah, according to him.
Well, she got loud and disturbed the other tenants. Well, Williams may have wished he could quiet her down.
I see. Well, what's your best opinion, Lee?
Looks to me like you've got some work to do.
Yeah, how's that?
I don't think he's a good suspect.
Tuesday, June 30th, we attended the postmortem on Lily Burnham. The coroner confirmed that death was due to manual strangulation. He fixed the time of death somewhere between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. the previous Friday. There was no evidence of sexual assault. On the basis of this information, Terry Williams was cleared and released. 11:30 a.m., Bill and I went back to the office. Bill contacted the real estate secretary, Ida Walters, and asked if she would check Lily Burnham's charge accounts. Miss Walters agreed and said she'd let us know. Friday, July 3rd, in response to a message from Ida Walters, we drove over to the Burnham Realty Company, 2:20 p.m.
I'm sorry I took so long.
That's all right, Miss Walters.
I knew Mrs. Burnham had many charge accounts, but nobody can find any cards or charger plates or anything, unless you found them with her.
No, ma'am, we don't have them.
Well, the only thing I could do was go through the files and look for old receipts and then verify that these accounts were still active.
Yeah.
It was the least I could do for... Anyway, it took time.
What did you find?
Two service station cards, diners club, carte blanche, an air travel card, just about all the major department stores, and Bank AmeriCard. I made this list.
Thank you.
Sergeant, is it true what the papers say that Mrs. Burnham was... It happened last Friday afternoon?
Yes, ma'am. It's been verified.
Then I'm right.
How do you mean?
This statement just came in today from Barton's Wilshire.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, it shows that Mrs. Burnham bought a diamond wristwatch for over $400. At first, I thought the store had made a mistake.
But you called the store, did you?
Yes, sir. They said there was no mistake. They were very positive. I knew then that there was something wrong. I mean, it just isn't possible. Burnham couldn't put a charge on her account the day after she was... Excuse me.
All right, whoever it was stole her credit cards. Figured that way he'd buy a lot of stuff that he could sell off later. He'd need a woman to use those cards.
That's right.
Made an appointment with Mrs. Burnham to look at a house. Got her alone.
Yeah.
Then he killed her. ...4 p.m., a description of the suspect's M.O. was circulated to all police departments. A different version of this bulletin was sent to a real estate trade journal for publication. Tuesday, July 7th, a response to our bulletin came in from Phoenix, Arizona.
Man identified as Carl Keegan, alias William Simpson, victimized 9 women in Phoenix. Same M.O., stole credit cards.
Yeah, what about the description?
Good one. This Keegan's wanted on a fugitive warrant.
Yeah.
He jumped bail down there.
1 week passed. Tuesday, July 14th. We got a call from Sergeant Jack Williams, Robbery Division. He said he thought he might have something for us. Bill and I went down to the robbery squad room to see him.
Friday, Gannon.
Jack, how's it going?
Can't complain. Got a bank series going that's keeping us on the run.
Is that right?
A couple of on-ramp specialists. They're really hitting pretty good.
You said you might have something for us.
Yeah, on that realty thing you guys are working.
What do you got?
Just got back in from talking to this woman. Lady realtor down near Inglewood. Name's Roy, Ardith Roy.
Yeah, what about her?
Says about 4 days ago, she was out showing a house to a prospective buyer. Said the guy appeared interested in the house and told her he'd check back with her about making a deal in a few days.
Yeah.
Roy woman said she wrote it off as a no sale. The guy left her at the empty house. She locked up and started back for her office. On the way back, she stopped for a tank of gas. When she went to give the attendant her credit card, she noticed it was gone. Not only her gas card, but all of her cards.
Now, the man she was showing the house to, did he give a name?
Yeah, Simpson. William Simpson.
She gave you a description?
Yeah. It's all down here. There's more.
Go ahead.
Well, she figured until today, maybe she just lost the cards or misplaced them. She finished checking her morning mail. That's why she called in.
Yeah.
She got a bill from Mallard, you know, the sporting goods store?
Yeah.
Well, the bill was for $780. Most she ever bought there was a catcher's mitt for her son's birthday.
Did you check the store?
Yeah. Clerk remembers a rather nice-looking girl who charged the stuff. He asked for identification. The girl showed him all the other credit cards, so naturally he didn't question the purchase. Big store. Doubtful if anybody would know the Roy woman on site.
That it?
Well, that's it. Whoever you're looking for, sorry I can't serve him up on a plate, but it ties, doesn't it?
Sure sounds like it, Jack. Now, this realtor, she say anything about the man's behavior?
She said he appeared courteous, looked the house over carefully, appeared straight enough to her.
How'd this Simpson get to her purse, she say?
Told her she left it on the kitchen sink. The two of them wandered through the house. When they got to one of the back bedrooms, the guy said he'd like to take one more look at the kitchen. She stayed in the bedroom, and he went to the kitchen by himself.
Thanks, Jack.
Got anything going for you?
We put a notice in the Real Estate Trade Journal. About all we can do is wait and hope it brings rain.
And in the meantime, there are a lot of empty houses to show.
And a lot of credit cards to steal.
Wednesday, July 22nd, 10:45 a.m. We got our first break.
Woman realtor out of Pacoima just phoned in. Name's Esther Jenkins. Saw her notice in the trade journal. Says she's got a date to show a house in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Description fits Keegan.
11:15 a.m. We arrived at the address given us by the realtor who had telephoned in. Mrs. Esther Jenkins.
I think you'll really enjoy the home. It seems to have everything you're looking for.
Yes, I believe this is just what I want.
Hello. Would you gentlemen like to see the house?
Police officers.
Stand still.
You're Esther Jenkins?
That's right.
Just a moment. I don't think you have a right to do this.
We have a right to look at your identification.
And I'm entitled to know why.
You've been the route. There's a fugitive want on you. You jumped bail in Arizona. Let's have your name.
William Simpson.
Miss Jenkins, are you carrying any credit cards?
Yes, I am.
Would you mind showing them to us?
No, not at all. I always carry them with me. That's strange. I had them just a few minutes ago.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm positive. I always carry them with me.
I hope you're not accusing me of taking them.
Well, now, maybe your name's Esther Jenkins. That's what it says on these credit cards.
You can't do a thing until I talk to my attorney.
Ms. Jenkins?
Yes? Those are mine, all right.
All right, put your hands behind your back.
Just a minute. Who do you think you're pushing around?
We're not pushing you around, but since you don't seem to know, I'll tell you what your name is. It's Carl Keegan. You killed a realtor by the name of Lily Burnham, just like you would have this woman if she'd found out you stole these cards.
You can't prove any of that.
Well, we're going to try.
You made a mistake, and I'm not going to pay for it.
You're going to use a credit card?
Just seen is true. The names were changed to protect the innocent. On September 20th, trial was held in Department 185, Superior Court of the State of California for the County of Los Angeles. In a moment, the results of that trial. The suspect was found guilty of murder in the first degree. Murder in the first degree is punishable by death or confinement in the state prison for life, at the discretion of the court or jury trying the same. Subsequent investigation led to the identification and arrest of Carl Keegan's female accomplice, who was tried and found guilty on five counts of forgery.
Forgery is punishable by imprisonment in the state prison for not less than 1 year, nor more than 14 years, or by imprisonment in the county jail for not more than 1 year.
All right. At the beginning of this program, our topic was house building illiteracy. I went through from my observations. I gave out my stats. Okay, we might review that later. But I'm tracking down people over on another continent. So I'm going to pray Factory City, and we'll be back with you.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away.
3,000个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
大概因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的。七点钟准时安排送量。对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down, unless Mr. He finds a fresh supply, and soon.
If we don't get them the parts, six production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. connect them, and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on.
那这样对吧？那个我先提议再先回去，然后那边先紧急生产，好，然后等下你就赶快送过去，好，OK，好，谢谢。
Mr. Huh finally arrives, and he has good news.
小叶，小叶，老六。
He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. Hus.
So we're here with Dave Clark, Sr.
Okay. I've been on reaching out to people on another continent. As I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, it was like I spoke to two people here, one stateside, one of our regular listeners, and I'm not going to let the cat out the bag who it was and all this other stuff. But it was like Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, got very enlightened from, I'll say, one state here. Well, you know who you were. Not were, but are. Like I said, I don't want to let the kid out the bag there, but we're going to be moving in a direction strongly of Booker T. Washington. Then I spoke to a person over on the continent of Africa, and then I reached out to another one who I spoke to. And I'll give you a clue with this particular person and see if I can get it here on an interview. Young lady, she was unemployed in Kenya. And I'll just put it that way. I'm not going to give away. She taught herself a building trade. She taught herself a building trade. And now she's got a company with employees. So I've reached out to her while I was playing these audios this morning so we can get her on here. And we want to do some live streams so you can actually see these people, ask them questions yourself, and then projects that we will be doing because we'll be learning from them more than we'll be learning from us. So, and I want to get back to the, like I say, one person, when I regular listen, I'll be calling you back this afternoon. And then there's a time difference between me and the continent, a bigger time difference. So I want to get back to them as well. While it's, Africa's got its time zone. So, let me get back. So at the beginning, we talked about house building illiteracy. I put some numbers on this. I said the five primary causes of homelessness is, I said, number one, 80% of the people that are homeless are house building illiterate. They know absolutely nothing about house building, how to build a dog house or even a birdhouse. So I say 80% of the problem lies right there. That can be easily corrected, though. You can even do it through YouTube. Number two, geography. You're building or having built in the wrong place where you can have affordable housing. That includes property taxes. You know, if you can't afford to pay $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 or more in property tax a year, find an area where you can get it dramatically lower. Number three, mental health issues. Number four, cash flow. You just don't have enough cash flow coming in. But that can be fixed if you have, if your house building literate. And then, of course, you build in the right place. And then the last one I would say, at first I said nonprofit miseducation rituals that were sort of like directed towards churches based on the podcast that we had yesterday. However, today I'm just saying miseducation in general. So that's where we're at. Okay, that's what I wanted to get out today. But like I said, I had two pleasant phone calls before the program today, one right before it. And I don't want to let the cat out the bag with any names or nothing like that because I want to get things set up solid. And we're going to end for today because, like I said, I want to get back over to the continent with these conversations. Because, like I said, there's a time difference, so it's like evening in certain places. On that note, we'll see you guys tomorrow with an update.